So could you start by telling me your name and your current title?
So I'm Naomi Allen. I'm Professor of Epidemiology here at University of Oxford, and I'm Chief Scientist for UK Biobank.
Okay, thanks very much. And without telling me your entire life story, but just to give me a bit of background, just tell me how you got from your first interest in science to where you are now. How did your career unfold?
Well, like most people, it's quite a circuitous route. I actually did environmental science at university, my undergraduate at university, and graduated in a recession, was unemployed, couldn't get a job, and then just after a year of not doing very much, thought actually I really need to go back to education and do something that I'm really interested in. And the only thing that I was really passionate about at university was we did a module on epidemiology and public health. So I went back and I did a master's in epidemiology at the London School of Hygiene in Tropical Medicine in London. And I felt like I'd come home. It was just, I just absolutely loved it. And I haven't really looked back since then. I came here in Oxford to do my DPhil in the late 90s and became a cancer epidemiologist with a focus on breast and prostate cancer and how diet and hormones influences cancer. And then in 2011, I also started to work with UK Biobank as their senior epidemiologist. And that was really different because rather than just doing research and analysing data and writing papers, you're actually thinking about how can I help to set up and improve cohort studies? How can I engage the participants in collecting more valuable data for the global research community? So it's all about enabling others to use this fantastic resource, which I find hugely satisfying.
Well, we'll talk a bit more of that later, but I've got this question I've been asking everybody. If you could say, if there was one question that you could say really kind of gets you out of bed in the morning, what would it be?
Oh, for me, it would be how can we better measure our lifestyle and particularly our environment to find out more about how that impacts health. That's what gets me out of bed.
And what are the methods, the main methods that you use?
So the main methods are for finding out about people's lifestyle factors. It's simple. We ask them questionnaires about their diet, physical activity, how did they sleep. And of course, more recently, we can now use fancy devices like Fitbits and apps on phones to find out more about their sleeping habits, their physical activity, and even down to having sleep monitors on their head to measure their activity in their brain and MRI machines to measure the volume of their heart chambers. I mean, it's just astonishing the amount of information you can collect on individuals now.
So it's very much about data.
Oh, it is. I mean, yes. The more data we can collect on individuals and how they interact with their environment, couple that with information on their genetic profile, then suddenly you could open up this wonderful box and find out how your people's genetic profile, together with exposures to their lifestyle and wide, broader environment, interacts to influence disease many years later.
So that's really brought us very neatly to Biobank. So let's, for the benefit of people who don't know about it, go back to the beginning. What is UK Biobank? How was it set up and what's it setting out to do?
UK Biobank is arguably the world's most flexible and accessible biomedical resource for the global research community to use to perform health-related research that's in the public interest. So we recruited 500,000 individuals in the UK about 15 years ago, aged 40 to 70. And we collected all sorts of information on them, lifestyle factors, physical measures. We took biological samples from them. And then we're following them up over many decades through linkage to their medical records and through asking them through questionnaires to find out about their health. And from that, we've made this huge database available for approved researchers worldwide to access this incredibly valuable data set for the world's best imaginative minds to mine this data set to find out about the causes and determinants of a whole range of diseases. So that's what UK Biobank's about, in essence.
And what's your role as chief scientist?
So my role is I'm largely responsible for making sure we follow up the health of all 500,000 participants through linkage to a broad range of medical records and other health-related records to make that available to the worldwide community. And also to talk to the researchers about what would make UK Biobank better. What's over the next 5-10 years, the technology is changing so rapidly. How can we make the resource even better in the future? Is that through more different measures that we can perform in the blood samples? Is that through doing repeat measures on the participants? Is that through doing slightly different measures now that the cohort are aging? What can we do to better enhance the study to make it really valuable to enable researchers to answer the most important research questions of the day?
Mm. I know this is just a kind of side thing to cover, but how is it funded?
So it's largely funded by the Wellcome Trust and the Medical Research Council in the UK. And it was set up, and it had some additional funding from local governments as well. But over the last 5 years, we've also received industry funding to do specific enhancements to the resource. So, for example, a consortium of pharmaceutical companies have funded whole exome sequencing, which measures the genome that encodes for the proteins. And again, a consortium of pharmaceutical companies together with government and charity have funded whole genome sequencing. We have pharmaceutical companies investing in UK Biobank to fund measuring circulating proteins in the blood, measuring circulating metabolites in the blood. So really, industry are starting to invest in this study to measure proteins, metabolites and genes in order to really accelerate their drug discovery work. And all those data are made available to the global research community to further enhance scientific discoveries.
So academic and commercial research, the resource is available to both academic and commercial research?
It is, yeah, and it's available on exactly the same terms. So academics and researchers from the commercial world can access the data at the same cost, the same terms and conditions, and the only thing that we really are obliging researchers to do in return is to return all of their results back to UK Biobank. So whether that's results from assays that they've performed on the blood samples, or whether they've derived a new variable from the MRI scans, all that data, plus the research data that they've done on the resource, is returned back to UK Biobank so that others can build on the findings that have been made. So it's one of the first studies in the world, actually, to really enforce this really collaborative, open way of performing science and kind of building on what others have already achieved.
And what of it, if you had to pick out, you probably do at talk sometimes, some of the more impressive achievements of people who've been using the resource, what would you pick on?
So I would say over the last couple of years, what we're finding that's coming out of the UK Biobank resource is in 2017, we made available genetic data on 500,000 participants, and it was the world's largest study at that time to do so. That led literally overnight to an explosion of research into the genetic determinants of disease. From that work, that's led to a concept called polygenic risk scores. So this is where you look at all the genetic variants across an individual's genome, each of which only has a very small increased risk of disease. But when you add them all together, what you find is that people say unfortunately, in the highest fifth percentile of genetic risk across variants or their genome, have substantially increased risk of, say, breast cancer or prostate cancer or heart disease. And you can say the same about pretty much every condition. And that's actually equivalent to many diseases that are monogenic in order. And what we found is that if you can use this polygenic risk score idea, to that it's really started to galvanize the whole area of precision medicine. So you can imagine, for example, going to your GP, having a blood test done, they'll look at your genetic sequence and they'll say, well, you've got, you know, a 10% risk of developing heart disease by the age of 30, 75 based on your genetic predisposition alone. We might want to think about perhaps taking preventative measures like taking statins to reduce your cholesterol or doing lifestyle advice. So you can see how this idea of knowing an individual's genetic profile and how that may influence risk can then start to tailor either screening programs or targeted treatments or preventative advice to those individuals who are at increased genetic risk of a certain disease. So I think that's by far been, to date anyway, the biggest broad achievement of the resource.
So let's finally arrive at COVID. Can you remember where you were, what you were doing, or how you first heard that there was a pandemic in the offing?
I remember being in a meeting in London, and it must have been February of 2020, and everybody was whispering under the, before the meeting started, there was, oh, have you seen the news? Have you seen this? And there was, somebody showed me something on Twitter, and it was this graph that was just going upwards. And it was a number of people in Wuhan who had been diagnosed with this strange virus. And there was all this talk about, oh, well, you know, it might not come over here and we might be all right. And then, oh, but no, it's already happening in Italy, and Italy's really, if it can happen in Italy, it can happen anywhere. So there was this sense of unease about the rapid spread of something that was very unknown. And we were kind of sitting ducks. And there was a real sense that, oh my God, there is this wave of infection that is killing people rapidly. And it was, I remember it very well. It was a sense of like cold shivers down your spine. Like, oh my God, this is going to really change things in this country and we are not prepared.
Right, yes. So having got over the shock, how soon was it before you and your colleagues felt that this was something that Biobank could contribute to?
Straight away. So it must have been end of March 2020. So just as we were entering the first lockdown, the Department of Health and Social Care got in touch with us and said, could you set up a study to find out what's going on in the UK? You know, we want to know the spread of infection across the UK and in different population subgroups. How is it by age, by sex, by region, and so on? And more importantly, how long, once people who have been infected with the virus, how long do their antibodies last over time? And that was a crucial question, because nobody knew that once you'd been infected, were you immune forever after that? How long were you protected for? And knowing answers to that question had a real impact, of course, on vaccine rollout and how long you should space the vaccine. So we very quickly mobilised all our resources to set up this seroprevalence study to find out the extent of past infection across the UK and how long antibodies last for.
Just using the UK Biobank participants?
Well, so,
because there was another, I mean, I've interviewed Derek Crook, and I've interviewed Sarah Walker, and I'm beginning to get slightly confused.
It is pretty
how
confusing.
These things interact.
So for the first time, because he wanted to find out what was the rate of past infection across different age groups, and all of our participants are now in their 60s, early 70s, for the first time ever, we got the kids and the grandkids of the existing participants involved, and we were absolutely bowled over with their willingness to contribute to the study. And I think within 5 days of putting out an email to the participants and saying, if you've got children who want to involve, let them know, we had over 100,000 people volunteer to join the study. We only needed 20,000 to find out really what was going on across the country. So we were bowled over with support. And yeah, hopefully it means that the value of doing this type of epidemiological study was not just in the forefront of the mind of the participants, but also their wider families.
And you must have needed to collaborate with other organisations, because you needed their test results, presumably.
We did was we sent a tiny blood sampling device, which literally you prick the end of your finger and you squeeze it to get a drop of blood into a little test tube, you wrap it up, pop it in the post. So it was dead simple for people to use. And then that went to one of our collaborating labs, which is just over the way here in Oxford, and they set up in double quick time an assay that could measure the main antibody to the spike protein of the coronavirus.
So that was Derek Crooks.
That was outfit. Derek Crooks' yes, yes. outfit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so all the samples, well, they were first sent to our coordinating laboratory, so a Royal Mail van came every day with these 20,000 samples, and we collected samples every single month for 6 months from 20,000 individuals. So it was an awful lot of samples that we had to unpack, aliquot, put into little plates, put them on dry ice, courier them down to Oxford to Derek Crooks' lab. They then had to unpack them, measure them. It was a huge, huge effort all round, but we got fantastic data on how long antibodies to coronavirus, so we could tell who had been previously infected with the virus, how long antibodies lasted over a 6 month period. And what we found was really clear data, actually, that almost everybody who'd been infected in the first wave, so March, April, May in 2020, nearly everybody still had antibodies 3 months later. And the vast majority, 88%, still had antibodies 6 months later. So what we're doing now is we've just sent a final sample at the back end of last year, so in December of 21, to all of these 20,000 individuals to find out if their antibodies persist 12 to 18 months after infection, because that's still an outstanding question. We know antibodies wane because people get reinfected. But we don't actually know, does that vary by age? Does that vary by ethnicity? And just what does that trajectory look like in terms of the waning of protection, likely protection from infection? So that's something that we're looking at now.
Mm-hmm. So that, I mean, I assume the ONS study was also looking at serology. How did your results compare with theirs? And I mean, is there a difference in your approach?
Well, they're very complementary. I mean, the ONS study looked at households, again, across the UK, and they didn't have intense repeat measures like UK Biobank had. So we were able to collect monthly blood samples from 20,000 individuals. ONS, it's a larger subsample, but they don't collect blood samples as frequently as we did.
Right.
So that's the main difference. But they're complementary, and it was really useful when we were going through, when we were in the teeth of the pandemic, if you like, talking to ONS and the REACT study and our study about just how complementary our findings were, particularly around the spread of the virus across the UK, you know, be higher rates in elderly people, higher rates in ethnic minorities, higher rates in urban areas, and the possible reasons why that might be.
So presumably you were also, because you're connected to people's health records, you know, you would get sort of, as people in the study became infected, you would see that. Were you able to use that data along with all your environmental and genetic data to try and answer questions about who was getting infected?
So the short answer was yes, but with some difficulty. So before the pandemic, we usually obtain health record data on an annual basis. So cancers, deaths, hospital admissions, and so on. When the pandemic first started, we thought, hang on a minute, this is no way near frequent enough to enable research into COVID, into the determinants of severe COVID-19. So researchers were coming to us saying, well, we could look at the what's the genetic predisposition to severe COVID-19? What are the lifestyle factors related to, you know, is smoking a risk factor? Is obesity a risk factor? Is ethnicity a risk factor? We could answer all these questions using UK Biobank. In order to enable that, we had to have rapid updates of health record data, including COVID-19 testing data and critical care data from hospitals. So we worked very, very well with all the data providers, and we managed to get monthly updates of these data. And our poor data analyst team in UK Biobank literally worked around the clock to make hospital inpatient data, death data, COVID-19 tested data. And we were able to, there was emergency legislation that was introduced called a COPI notice that enabled us to obtain primary care data, so data from GP practices, solely for the purposes of COVID-19. So we had to rapidly put in pipelines in place to process these millions and millions of rows of data from primary care records and make that available to researchers on a regular basis for COVID-19 research. And all our hard work was we felt vindicated in all of our hard work, because, I mean, I think within the first 6 months, there were 200 odd papers looking at the genetic determinants and the lifestyle and environmental determinants of severe COVID-19, and it made a real difference to our understanding of actually what are the main risk factors for severe COVID.
And what were some of the key findings?
So, I mean, obviously there's genetic predisposition to developing severe COVID-19. Ethnic minorities have an increased risk of contracting COVID-19 in the first place, and research that we've done in the seroprevalence study, because we also found that rates were much higher in Black and ethnic minorities. We then sent out a questionnaire asking about their behaviour. Do you work in a public-facing role? Do you have public transport? Whereabouts do you live? How many people live in your household? All those questions we thought might be relevant to see if we could that could explain why ethnic minorities were more likely to catch COVID. And what we found was that actually it was the type of job that you had, particularly whether you worked in the NHS or whether you had a public-facing role, and where you lived. So whether you lived in an urban area, and particularly if you lived in the London area of the UK, you were much more likely to develop COVID-19. And that explained 2/3 of the excess risk in Black and ethnic minorities. So, and it was less to do with the number of people in the household and so on. So that was quite interesting, the social and economic determinants of COVID.
Mm. So that overturned a lot of assumptions people had been making about multi-generational households.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. And then research coming out from the broader research community, looking at all of the data that we had in UK Biobank, put to bed the fact that vitamin D was protective for COVID-19. That was a big hypothesis that was out there, and actually there was no real evidence to suggest that. It found that obesity was a strong risk factor for developing severe COVID-19, and also underlying health conditions. So if you had diabetes or even depression and cardiovascular disease, you're more likely to develop severe COVID-19 and subsequent complications. And also if you'd had previous vaccines to like diphtheria or tetanus, whether they were more likely to protect you from subsequent COVID-19. So some really interesting research into the determinants of the disease coming out of the resource.
Mm, mm. And were any of those findings converted into policy changes on the fly, as it were?
Well, I think it certainly led to a greater understanding of the likely causes of COVID-19. And there was, I think, in the general public consciousness, people were aware that if you were obese and if you were an ethnic minority and if you had underlying comorbidities, that you were somehow more vulnerable to COVID-19. Whether that led to direct changes in policy in real time is less clear. I mean, the policy work that came out of our serial prevalence study in the 20,000, I think really did lead to some changes, because it helped to influence, okay, well, if we know antibodies last for at least 6 months in the majority of people, that actually has an impact on how often you're going to vaccine people. So that was, I think, a main contribution of in terms of policy and what people were doing on the ground.
So another study you did was one that you called the antibody self-test or self-test antibody.
Yes. So once we'd finished our seroprevalence study, we were making all the electronic health records available to the research community. They were getting on doing this fantastic research into finding the determinants of COVID-19. We then moved our attention to think about, what about long COVID? You know, and quite early on in the pandemic, there were growing anxieties that this wasn't just a respiratory illness, that it had real systemic, in some people, real systemic effects, brain fog, complete exhaustion, as well as the cough and the fever, you know, muscle aches that lasted for months, loss of sense of taste and smell that did last for months in some individuals. So it seemed to be a more systemic virus with wider health consequences. So we thought UK Biobank would be the ideal resource to look at that, because it's a longitudinal study that follows up people over time. So what we did was, we wanted to find out, kind of objectively as possible, who had developed COVID, who had been exposed to the virus. Because we knew from our serology work that about 25% of the population had antibodies to coronavirus, but they never thought they'd had COVID.
As many as 25%?
Yes, yes. And 40% of those who were positive didn't have the three main symptoms that were eligible for testing way back in the first wave. So there's thousands of people walking around, certainly in 2020, who had contracted the virus, but either weren't eligible for testing because they didn't have the main symptoms, or they didn't have any symptoms at all. So we then sent out a self-test antibody lateral flow test. So these were little devices you sent in the post. You just put a finger prick of blood onto the little cassette, and within 15 minutes, it tells you whether you've got antibodies to the virus or not. And so these were provided by the Department of Health and Social Care, and Amazon kindly distributing all the kits for free.
How did that relationship come about?
Well, we already had an ongoing relationship with Amazon for some of our other projects. So, and they just wanted to help. There was a real sense of, what can we do to help figure out what's going on with COVID, particularly long COVID. And so Amazon were like, yeah, we'll deliver your kits to 500,000 participants. So we developed a really close working relationship with them about...
So every participant got one of those?
Well, so we invited every participant to have one of these kits, and over 200,000 actually had a kit, did the test, and gave us a result, which was fantastic. Unfortunately for us, this all happened in 2021, just as the first vaccines were starting to be rolled out. And the kit that we sent out, they test for antibodies to the virus. They couldn't distinguish between antibodies produced from infection and antibodies produced from the vaccine. So we were really up, the clock was ticking to get these kits out before people were jabbed. And I won't bore you with the details, but we had huge delays getting MHRA approval to use these tests in the home for research purposes. It has to go through a long bureaucratic
approval. Because it involves blood?
Because it involves blood. Mm. It's a medical device, so it needs to be approved by the authorities. And it wasn't being used by a health professional. It was being used by Joe Bloggs in their home for research purposes. That took months to get approved. Meanwhile, people are starting to get jabbed, and we knew that the test couldn't differentiate between the two. So what we had to do was ask people, have they been vaccinated? If so, when? And if they had a positive antibody result, we then had to send them another test that got sent to a different laboratory, which could tell whether the antibodies were from the vaccine or from previous infection. So it was a hugely complex and frustrating project. But at the end of it, we've got data back from over 200,000 individuals on whether they were previously infected with the virus, irrespective of whether they had symptoms or not. Incorporating that data into UK Biobank, that will enable really large-scale epidemiological research into the longer-term health effects of being infected, regardless of whether you had symptoms or not. So some individuals were completely asymptomatic, others were hospitalised. So it will enable research into the effects of long COVID across the full disease spectrum. So obviously this research will take months, years, as you know, long COVID plays out over the ensuing months. But that data, coupled with the vaccination data, which we're just putting into the resource, will be, I think, a unique biomedical data set for people to work on the effects of coronavirus infection for months and years to come, actually.
And now you mentioned that it's very much a systemic condition, and one of the things it affects, well, it affects multiple organs, and you've got scans of some of your participants.
We have, yeah. So another way that we thought we could enable research into long COVID was by taking advantage of our ongoing imaging study. So before the pandemic, we're embarking on a hugely ambitious program to perform MRI scans on 100,000 participants, of which we're halfway through. So by the end of 2019, we'd imaged 50,000 participants. So this involves MRI of the brain, heart, body, abdomen, full body DEXA scan, carotid ultrasound. It's a four-hour visit. It's very intensive for the participants, but it provides just unique, invaluable data on the physiology and the structure and function of organs. So 50,000 participants had already undergone an imaging assessment before the pandemic. So we thought, well, why not bring some of these participants back for a repeat scan? Half of whom we know have been infected with coronavirus, and we can tell that either from this self-test and lateral flow antibody kit that we sent to them, or that they've been diagnosed with COVID from linkage to medical health records. And then we'll bring back, so there are cases, if you like, cases with COVID-19, and we'll match them to controls, so matched similarly to age, sex, where they had their imaging assessment, when they had their imaging assessment done. And we managed to invite back 2,000 individuals. So this is the largest study in the world of the effect of coronavirus on internal organs. And it's the only study in the world that's got imaging scans of participants before they were infected with the virus and after they were infected with the virus. So it enables research into the likely direct effect of coronavirus on changes in internal organs. So for example, you could look at the effect of coronavirus in changes in the heart, in the heart structure or the heart function in some way. And it's unique because it's the only study in the world that's got imaging scans before and after infection, and again across the full disease spectrum. Most other studies, lots of studies have looked at the effect of COVID on imaging internal organs, but they tend to recruited people who are hospitalised with the disease, and of course they've only got the scans after they were infected.
Yeah.
So
Particularly severe cases.
They're particularly severe cases. That's right. So it's impossible to look at the effect of the virus, because you don't know what the baseline was. You don't know what their function was before they were infected. So we were thrilled to be able to perform this study last year. And as I said, we managed to get 2,000 individuals come back. Despite all the COVID restrictions, they were willing to come back for a second visit. And now that data is available to the research community, and already some really interesting findings are starting to come out of that.
Can you pick a few of them?
Yeah, so the first finding to come out of this unique study is the effect, the likely effect of coronavirus infection on the brain. So what researchers based here in Oxford have shown is that those individuals who are infected with coronavirus, most of whom developed mild symptoms, they had a greater decline in grey matter in the brain, in all different areas of the brain, but particularly in the olfactory region, so the region of the brain related to sense of smell and taste. So this decline in grey matter volume...
What's the significance of grey matter?
So the significance of grey matter is this is the part of the brain that's really responsible for how it works, all the neural connections in the brain. So if you've got a reduction in that part of the brain, it suggests that your connections are perhaps lower, or that there may be, at least over the short term, some reduction in how that area of the brain works. So the fact that one of the main symptoms is loss of sense of taste and smell, it was quite interesting to see that actually there was a corresponding reduction in the volume of the brain in this area. And also the researchers found that there was likely to be an increase in the time it took participants to perform some cognitive function tests. So as well as having an MRI, they also performed a range of different tests to measure thinking and memory and so on. And while these differences were not big, they were there. So of course, what we don't know is how long these differences will last. I mean, the brain is usually plastic, it can recover, we know that. So the good news is that we hope that these are not permanent reductions in the brain, and not permanent changes in cognitive function. And of course, you know, only further MRI scans will really be able to answer that. Mm. But very interesting that you can actually, that the effect of the virus, even in mild cases, it really does seem to have an effect on the structure and possibly the function of the brain, at least over a couple of month period.
And I'm wondering whether that's something you might repeat to see whether the Omicron variant and the BA2 variant act any differently from the previous variants that people have.
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, we don't have that granular information about variants. Not everybody who has a PCR test for COVID has their virus sequenced.
Oh, I see, yes.
And actually, we don't yet have that information in the UK Biobank resource. There are work underway to try and marry the two different data sets up. So at the moment, that type of research isn't possible.
But there've been waves of the different variants, haven't there? So just from the time a person becomes infected, you've got a good guess at what
you've got a good guess. Mm. Yeah. So as you say, depending on when they contracted the disease, or when they were infected, you've got a pretty good guess at what variant they most likely had. So it'll be very interesting to see with the long COVID work, as to when people were infected, we know it changes the symptoms that they get acutely, does that change the downstream long COVID consequences as well? And that's something that we don't know yet, and that hopefully over the next coming months and years we'll be able to answer that.
So do you have any in-house research programs, or is this all other people coming to you and saying, can we use your data to answer this question?
So our job at UK Biobank is to build the resource to enable other researchers to use it. So by and large, we don't do the research ourselves. We have a small epidemiological and analyst team here. And, you know, sometimes we do our own research, but we're treated as researchers just like anybody else. So we have no preferential or exclusive access to the data. So if we're particularly interested in some research question, we might ourselves put in an application to use the data and answer that. But essentially, our job at UK Biobank is to build a resource.
So, yes, I think I've covered all those. I've covered that. We've talked about health data linkage. And we talked about long COVID. So how do you think this work will help to plan future strategy for this pandemic? And you know, I think we have to expect there will be future pandemics.
I think what I'd like to think, which may be very different to ask. Oh, I'm so sorry.
That is you and not me.
Yeah, come on.
Okay.
So what I think the pandemic, if there's any silver lining to the pandemic, is that everybody became familiar with epidemiology and the importance of epidemiology. I couldn't believe that people were talking around the dinner table about the R number and T cells. And to me, having a wider public discourse about science can only be a good thing. I mean, everybody became armchair epidemiologists overnight. And I just think that's wonderful. And I just really hope that stays in the public consciousness and the government as well, about the importance of these large-scale population-based epidemiological studies, because they're very expensive to run. They take 20, 30 years to really come to maturity because you're following people over decades. But actually, they're crucial to find out about the determinants of disease, and particularly find the determinants of pandemics. So when, you know, coronavirus came along, UK Biobank was already up and running. If we had to build a study from scratch, we'd still be there recruiting people 2 years later. So being able to tap into existing resources and existing studies to suddenly focus on trying to understand the distribution of the disease and then the determinants of the disease can only really be done with existing large-scale population studies. So I hope that epidemiology has kind of earned its place at the table now and is recognised as being absolutely crucial to public health in this country and globally.
I suppose one thing we didn't talk about, another potential consequence of having a data set like this, is that it may actually point to where, particularly with the genetic information, where there might be targets that pharmaceutical companies or researchers can focus on to try and make some new treatments.
Absolutely. I mean, the whole reason why pharmaceutical industry have invested, and it's millions of dollars, to perform whole exome and whole genome sequencing on 500,000 participants, is to accelerate drug discovery work. Because if you find an association between a particular genetic variant and a disease, you've got a good bet that that genetic variant is somehow related. So if you can find a drug target that's built around that function of the gene, that's going to massively accelerate your drug discovery work. So absolutely, I mean, the resource is already, those data are already finding that there are genetic variants that are related from the exome sequencing data that are related to a much lower risk of developing obesity, which is kind of the holy grail of drug companies. Of course, you want a magic bullet to produce a drug to reduce rates of obesity. And so the exome sequencing data has really shone a light as to potential drug targets that can do exactly that. And the same is true for, you know, all sorts of diseases, including COVID and other diseases that will come in the future, for sure.
And you talked about the incredible public awareness. Were you personally involved in media appearances?
Yes,
yes. How did you find that?
It was very interesting because the media obviously wanna have an individual story, and epidemiology is all about the population. And so there's a little bit of tension between actually what you find on a population level and may not be directly relevant to an individual. And of course the media want very simple messages. And what we found with the pandemic it's not so straightforward. You know, even with the public messaging around COVID, where they try to really drill it down to three words, you know, face, space, hands, you know, it makes you realise that in order to get across a public health message, it really needs to be very simple and everybody needs to follow the rules. As soon as you start introducing nuance or error margins or maybes, they switch off. That's not what they want to hear. So there is a natural tension between scientists wants to err on the side of uncertainty and models and predictions with some caveats, to the media who want it in black and white, this is going to happen or this isn't going to happen, we're safe or we're not. So that's been quite an interesting journey.
Mm, yes, I mean, I could have gone away from what you said earlier and said, everybody's brain's going to decline. We'll all be vegetables in 10 years' time.
Yes, and I think the message there was really actually, you know, the reduction in the grey matter of the brain is actually pretty small. On average, it was about 2%, which in the grand scheme of things is quite small. We don't really know how clinically relevant that is in terms of your longer future health, because obviously we need to follow people up to find out that out. And also, given how plastic we know the brain is, you know, it may be that in 6 months' time, that difference is no longer there. So there's, you know, you could make a big splash of a headline going, oh my God, everybody who's got COVID has got smaller brain. Whereas actually, the reality is quite different.
Mm, mm, mm. And did you have any help with media work? Did you have any training or?
Some time ago, a few years ago, you know, because we talked to the media a lot about UK Biobank more broadly. Mm. Yeah. Mm.
So I'm just, we're well through it now. So has this work raised new questions that you're interested in exploring in the future?
Well, for me, it's really raised the importance, something I've always been interested in, but it's even made it higher on my priority list, if you like. It's about how important infectious diseases still are. You know, I've been focusing on cancer all my career. You know, you think of cancer, cardiovascular disease is the two main important things. And actually, because we've got linkage to cancer registries and linkage to hospital inpatient data, they're quite easy to study. Other diseases, like COVID, but also things that you go to your GP about, but don't make it into hospital. So things like, you know, arthritis, asthma, diabetes, actually eczema, they've been relatively under-researched because as epidemiologists, we haven't had access to the data about who's got all of these things. So in my mind, one thing, what I'm trying to say is I've become very much more interested in the role of infectious diseases and how that impacts chronic disease. Mm. So in terms of long COVID, it may be that, you know, coronavirus in some individuals may lead to longer term health consequences. We know other viruses cause cancer, HPV, Epstein-Barr virus, hepatitis C. We know that they cause cancer. And, you know, we now know that EBV can cause multiple sclerosis. So the role of infections is not just in their acute infectious disease symptoms, it's actually they may cause chronic longer term disease down the line. So I've become very interested in the role of infections in longer term chronic disease. And I think coronavirus has just kind of made me more aware that actually we need to look at these as exposures as well as outcomes in their own right.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
So things like, I'm just thinking of things like urinary tract infections, which are incredibly common, but regarded as a bit trivial.
Exactly. Really interesting. So what are the health impacts of those who've had UTIs 5-10 years later? Mm. And it's only by having thousands and thousands of people you can really try to tease out those small effects, because they will be small.
And how did the first lockdown impact on what you were able to do? So we haven't really talked, you said your colleagues were very busy, but it must have changed your life as well.
Well, it's changed all of our lives, didn't it? I mean, we It was quite interesting. I had a new member of staff, and her first day in the office was the end of March. It was our last day in the office, was her first day in the office, and she came to work here because, you know, she wanted to work in a big team and lots of group chats, and actually, well, you can only do that for a day because we're working from home, and literally overnight we all had to be set up with, you know, VPN systems so we can log in and do our work. We all had to have Microsoft Teams, and I was working from, you know, a tiny box room, our spare bedroom, and, you know, suddenly you're working for 14 hours a day on calls. But actually, I look back on it quite fondly because we were all working frenetically towards a common goal. Like, we've got to set up this study, we've got to do it in double quick time. And it was all hands on deck, and we all felt we were doing something important. And it kind of, we all pulled together across the whole organisation, and we all worked really, really, really well together. Because normally in your day-to-day things, you don't have that real sense of urgency. You're all working on slightly different things, slightly different timelines. And it was the first time I've ever experienced this kind of all hands on deck mentality. And we were all working at silly hours and messages flying around everywhere as to how to do things. And it was hugely rewarding. It was exhausting, but it was hugely rewarding for all of us, I think, involved.
And do you think it helped to support your own well-being, the fact that you knew you were doing something important?
Oh, for sure, for sure. I mean, you know, lots of my friends who were on furlough, who were, you know, picking up hobbies that they you know, put down years ago, and worrying about money and having to homeschool their children. And I think if we were lucky in that we were focused on one task, and it was just down the rabbit hole with that, and everything else was kind of pushed to one side. So I think that kind of bunker mentality kind of did, you didn't have time to think about anything else or how scary it was or what have you. But I mean, millions of people were affected, both in terms of loved ones being really ill, but also having to homeschool young children while they're trying to work. You know, I can't tell you the amount of times we had Zoom calls and there were little kids, you know, under the desk or popping up to say hello. It's hugely challenging, but good fun.
And one thing a number of people I've spoken to have said is that, no, I mean, academic life can be quite competitive, and you're constantly worrying about getting your next paper out and so on. I mean, you already work in a fairly collaborative way, but was this noticeably more collaborative? And do you think that's a lesson for getting stuff done?
It was definitely more collaborative. Yeah. I mean, the fact that, I mean, we've been trying to get access to primary care data for years, and overnight it happened because there was emergency legislation through a COPI notice that basically told the systems suppliers to make the primary care data available for UK Biobank for COVID-19 research only. So, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. And so, yeah, huge collaboration at all levels, and a real sense of working on it together. And everybody from the Department of Health and Social Care, from Amazon, from other academic colleagues, just wanting to do anything to help, and really cutting through the red tape to try and speed things up. So I really hope that, you know, translates into more cooperation in the future.
So do you think that having pushed that primary care data door open, you might be able to hang on to it?
I really hope so. I really hope so. You know, I mean, it's silly, really, because the government made the primary care data available only for COVID-19 research because there's a pandemic. And yet there's more people died of cardiovascular disease than COVID. We've got pandemics of cancer and pandemics of cardiovascular disease and dementia going on all the time. So the fact that they made this data available only for COVID-19 because we're in an emergency, well, we're in a dementia emergency, we're in a cancer emergency. So why can't you make the data available for that to me, it just doesn't make any sense. And I'm hoping that once we've shown that the data can be used responsibly, that it is of real scientific added value to find out the determinants of disease, then there will be, we'll have an easier path to try and make this data available for research into all conditions, not just COVID-19.
Mm-hmm. So, were you also involved in, or involved in any way, in the kind of safety regime for the department? Deciding when it was safe to come back and how to come back and that kind of thing.
For UK Biobank, we have, you know, our chief operating officer and health and safety, you know, that was really their remit.
Yes,
but,
yes.
We're all have a say in what works for us, how we feel safe, when we should be going back in, COVID safety measures, particularly for participants who are, you know, some of whom are quite elderly, coming in for imaging assessments, how to really make sure they feel safe and that it is safe for them. So we've done a lot of work around that.
Mm-hmm. And you didn't have a problem getting PPE and that kind of thing that you needed in order to keep everybody safe?
Not in the imaging centres.
Yeah.
No, that was fine. But I think that was because we did the COVID imaging study in 2021 when the PPE was... The pipelines were all set up. It was really in the first wave of the pandemic that getting your hand on gloves and masks and gowns and stuff was a real problem.
Mm-hmm. So as an epidemiologist, you deal with risk all the time. You were obviously very aware of the risks that were around. Did you personally feel threatened by that, by the risk of actually getting the disease? Did you get the disease?
I've never had COVID, although it, as we speak, the rates are probably the highest they've ever been. And I've been very, very fortunate in no one in my immediate family has been really ill with it. I haven't lost anybody to it, unlike others. So I think I recognise, I'm very acutely aware that I've had a very easy time of it. And I've also noticed that those of us who've had an easy time of it may get a bit blasé about it. And you know, individuals who've lost loved ones or have been really ill before are still like, no, put your mask on, no, you know, 2 metres. So I think you just have to be mindful that everybody's had slightly different experiences and their personal experiences may actually be very, very different to your own. But so far, personally, I've been very, very fortunate.
So yes, this is the last question. Has your experience of the pandemic and everything that went with it changed your attitude or your approach to your work, and how would you like things to change in the future?
Well, so obviously overnight we had to move to home working, and it was more collaborative. We were talking to many more people than we would otherwise do, everybody wanting to help. And now that we're kind of coming out the other side, it has been hugely complicated about what does new normal look like for not just us here, but across the country, about working from home, coming into the office. It's a very emotional subject. And, you know, we're really having to think about, well, what is optimal for our team? And we're still figuring that out, what works best. You know, we recognise that actually getting everybody into the office 5 days a week is maybe not best for every, is not optimal for everybody's way of working. They've got long commutes. Most of us don't live in Oxford. You know, most of us have some caring responsibility. So actually, can we get the best, can we learn from COVID and get the best out of our staff by having some flexibility and reaching a new normal that looks a little bit different, but quite what that looks like and making sure that seems to be fair for everybody is more difficult than we originally thought.
Mm-hmm. So there's no question of just going back to how everything was before.
I think the world's moved on.
Yes, I think you're right.
I don't think we should be saying, right, it's over now, everybody back to coming into the office 5 days a week, because I think we've all recognised that we can be just as productive working from home. And actually, sometimes, if you want to focus on something and you don't want distractions, it's better to work from home, no matter what your job title is. And you can have a better quality of life. You don't have to sit in a car for 2 hours a day to get to the office. And yes, we recognise that we have to come in for meetings and have core days and the collaboration, and don't undervalue the importance of a quick chat around the kettle. But equally, there is just as much value as putting aside a day to really focus on a specific task, and you can do that at home just as well. So it's managing those. I think people expect very different things now. Post-COVID, they expect to be able to have some flexibility. They expect to be able to work from home a bit more. And I totally understand that. And I think we should be trying to optimise the way people work and think a bit more creatively about what's best for people.
Lovely. Thank you very much.
Thank you.